Welcome back, Maya. Okay, folks. So remind us if you need them that your project is due a week from today. Okay? You know, there's a guy in Times Square who used to, I don't know whether he's still there, but there's this guy who used to harass people, telling you the world was going to end. He'd come up to you and he'd say, "The world is going to end, repent, repent, repent." No. And half the time you feel a little pissed off that he's telling you this. The other half of the time you're terrified that it's actually going to come true. Okay? So I'm going to act like that guy. The world is going to end in a week. So you better get that project done. And the final exam is 2 days later. So you don't really have a whole lot of time buffer built in here. So you're moving. Keep moving. If you're not moving, start moving. If you're thinking about moving, get the process rolling, right? And if you haven't met as a group, if all you have are numbers from your spreadsheets, it's not the project, right? I mean, I could have run the spreadsheets myself. So if you plug the numbers, you come up with an optimal debt ratio. If it's just a collection of spreadsheets, you're missing the point. What I'm looking for is a narrative about your company, a story you're telling me about your company, about what it does well, what it does badly, and what it should do differently. That's really what I'm looking for in your final project. Okay? So use the numbers to deliver that message. One more thing. On Wednesday, I'll send out a spreadsheet with my email, which will ask for summary numbers for your companies as a group. So don't get freaked out, because on Wednesday, you're not going to have those numbers ready. But sometime during the weekend, hopefully Saturday, maybe Sunday morning, you're going to get the numbers for your company. What numbers? Things like your Jensen's Alpha, your return on capital, your cost of capital, etc. I'd like the numbers for your company, and I'd like you to email them back to me, because on next Monday, that's what the class is going to be about. It's going to be about all the companies you analyzed and what you found. How many companies came out as under-levered? How many over-levered? How much, what were the Jensen's Alphas for the company? So I need those numbers to get that process rolling, so I will send you that reminder. So let's go back to where we were on Wednesday. We were talking about dividends, and I'd looked at Disney and I'd looked at Vale. And I asked you to play the role of stockholders in the company, and I tried to sell you on the notion of trust me with your cash. Today I want to take a little tangent before I continue that process. We're in the middle of the political season right now, right? You're going to see all kinds of economic proposals being floated. So I'm going to throw a few ideas at you, and you tell me whether these are good or bad ideas. So here's the first one. U.S. companies right now have about $3 trillion in cash accumulated within the companies. Cash that they could return to shareholders that they're not. So I'm a politician, and I have an idea. I say, let's make every company in the U.S. pay out 40% of its earnings as dividends, a mandated dividend payout ratio. Let's have the power to make that go through. I want you to think about what types of companies will be hurt by this, and then let's talk about the implications. I'm going to list out some companies, and you tell me if you're this kind of company, whether you're going to be affected by a mandated payout ratio of 40% of your earnings. Large companies making big profits. Why not? You have lots of money you're making. You don't need to reinvest your mature company. You don't care. You'll pay 40% of your earnings as dividends. What about small companies losing money? Well, it's 40% of profits. If you're losing money, you don't care. You say, I don't care. And high growth companies losing money, you don't care either. But look, if you think about high growth companies making money, do you see why this mandated payout is going to be almost deadly for these companies? They're making money. But what do their free cash flows to equity look like? They're high growth companies. Their net income is positive. Their free cash flow to equity is negative. They can't afford to pay dividends. And I'm adding a 40% mandated payout ratio. I will kill these companies. That's terrible, right? But you know who's going to lobby strongest for a law like this? Who's going to lobby for this? Who benefits if young high growth companies can't make it? Large, mature companies, right? So in a sense, they'll shed their crocodile tears. This is terrible. We don't want regulation. And at the same time, they'll be pushing, pass the law. Because if you pass the law, effectively, you're undercutting the companies that can be competition. Let's look at the reverse. You heard of these, probably read some news stories about how U.S. companies are not investing enough. It's a big story. I mean, you hear it over and over again. Capital investment at U.S. companies has dropped off. And it has. U.S. companies are building less factories, investing less in R&D. And the culprit often is these companies are returning too much cash to their stockholders in the form of stock buybacks and dividends. So here's my second proposal. I'm at the opposite end of the spectrum. I'm going to mandate that every company has to reinvest 60% of its net income back into projects. Real projects, not in cash. It's got to go into factories and projects. Is that a good idea? We'll have a lot of factories, but a lot of jobs will be created, right? But what's the problem with requiring companies to reinvest? What are we doing in capital budgeting then if we require companies to reinvest? We're saying, don't care about your net present value. We don't care if you create value or not. Just go build more factories. Bottom line is, dividend policy is something government should never touch. Because no matter how you mandate things, you're going to benefit some groups and hurt others, and collectively it's always going to be a bad idea. So it's not like investors come to a great dividend policy, but maybe we can muddle through to something that works. But the minute you step in with one size fits all, it's going to be deadly for companies. So now I'm going to go back to what we were doing. Remember the role that you're playing. You're playing the role of shareholders of a company. I'm going to take you back to 1992. And I'm going to show you some numbers I ground out for British Petroleum. And this was actually as part of something that it was British Petroleum in 92 asked me to come in and talk to their. It's actually a very strange training session. One of the strangest ones I'd ever done, where I flew to London. And they flew a dozen of their brightest petroleum engineers in from different parts of the world, put them in a room with me and said, teach them all the corporate finance they need to know in 2 days. And you know what? These guys were smart. They had number crunching skills. They got it. The company I used, though, for them was not Disney or Vale. It was British Petroleum. It was a company they were familiar with. So I took them through the same process I did for Disney. I started at the beginning corporate governance, worked all the way through. And then I got to the dividend section, and I took the spreadsheet that I sent to you and filled in the numbers for BP and thought I'd screwed up. And here's why. The free cash flow to equity that I came up with for BP The free cash or equity that I came up with for BP was $571 million. Let me ask you a question. It's not a trick question. How much dividend can a company with $571 million in free cash or equity afford to pay out? $571 million, right? I mean, that's what the potential dividend is. That's a lot of money by itself. They actually paid out $1.5 billion in dividends every year for 10 years. How does a company with $571 million in cash available to pay out its dividends pay out its $1.5 billion every year? They went and borrowed $1 billion every year not to drill more wells, not to take better projects, not to do anything else but to pay dividends. It was the most dysfunctional dividend policy ever. It's every year for 10 years. You think this is a problem? Every year you come up with 571, you pay out $1.5 billion. It's a problem. Everybody knew it was a problem. Who's everybody, including the janitor at BP, knew it was a problem? You know how he knew? He said, I'd like a new broom. And BP said, not this year. We need every pound we have to pay dividends. Maybe 6 years from now, you'll have a stick and maybe we'll fix something. Everybody at BP knew it was a problem. For a long time. So here's the follow-up question. If everybody knew it was a problem, why didn't somebody do something about it, right? Why not in 86 or 87 or 88? So let me take you back to 1987, to a top management meeting at BP, and let's see why nothing gets done. So you're sitting around this big oval table at BP headquarters. My Oxbridge accent is not that good, but I'll try. So we have a dividend problem, old boy. I, everybody around the table agrees there's a dividend problem. We've got to cut dividends, old boy. I, everybody kind of agrees we've got to do something about it. There are only old boys around the table anyway, so you're saying that's pretty sexist. This is 1987. At BP, it's Lord so-and-so, Viscount so-and-so sitting around the table. Everybody's ready to cut dividends, but nothing happens. You're saying, why not? I'll tell you a fairy tale that I used to be really fond of when I was a kid. It's about these mice who live in an abandoned house, and they're being terrorized by this cat. So the mice decide they want to do something about this cat. They call a mice meeting. I've never been at a mice meeting, but it's probably pretty chaotic, mice running around all over the place. And they come up with plans to do something about the cat. And one of the mice has an absolutely brilliant idea. He says, let's put a bell on the cat. That way we'll know when he's around. We can go scurry away, hide. Everybody agrees, aye, brilliant idea. Until one of the more practical mice asks the key question, which is, who the hell is going to put the bell on the cat? Not me. Let's go back to the BP top management meeting. Everybody agrees you should cut dividends, right? Until one of the managers says, who's going to tell our stockholders? You say, what's wrong with telling the stockholders? You can't afford the dividends. You should tell them the truth. I don't know whether I used these words, but I think I did last session. I talked about when you pay small dividends, you get investors who like small dividends. When you pay big dividends, you get investors who like big dividends. When you pay obscenely big dividends, you get dividend addicts buying your shares. They're in the room. They're the shareholders. And what are you going to tell them? You're going to cut their dividends. Well, good luck with that. So all of a sudden, everybody discovers that they're going to have laryngitis 6 months from now. I can't say, you know, not me. Everybody goes around the table. Nobody wants to tell the stockholders. Until one of the guys comes up with an absolutely brilliant idea. He says, let's wait. Maybe something good will happen. Which for an oil company is what? Maybe oil prices will go up and our problem will go away. There was a brief period in 1991 when Saddam Hussein wandered into Kuwait and oil prices actually jumped for about 4 weeks, and you could see people at BP dancing on their tables, and no more dividend problem. But a few weeks later, it was back. Finally, in 1992, BP cut dividends. Somebody had the courage of their convictions, right? Why do you think they cut dividends? Where did they come up with $1 billion every year to pay these dividends? They were the most highly levered oil company. They were a basket case by 1992, and the bank said, not this year. This is a sensible thing to do, right? Cut dividends. You can't afford them. To show you there's no justice in the world, this is the newspaper article that shows up the day after dividends get cut. BP shares plummet after dividend is slashed. Well, I should really tell you the full story. 3 months later, the stock had fully recovered and BP was a healthier company. This was the best thing that BP did. In hindsight, But during those 3 months, what do you think was happening? Those dividend addicts were all leaving the room, and a new group of investors were coming in, but it wasn't instantaneous. And during the three-month period, half of BP's top managers lost their jobs. And guess what? I feel zero sympathy for them. Why? Because they waited to cut dividends when they had no choice. They had 10 years where they could have done something, but they chose to keep putting it off and putting it off and putting it off until it was thrust upon them. Cutting dividends is never easy. I'm not going to tell managers, do it, nothing bad will happen to you. But if you're going to cut dividends, you have to do it on your terms, which means you got to do it when you control the process, and you should be as transparent as you can about why you're doing it. Let me explain. This was actually a study that looked at dividend cuts motivated for different reasons. So first was dividend cuts that were motivated by the fact that your earnings had dropped off. Okay? The second was dividend cuts were motivated by earnings drops in previous periods. And the third was dividend cuts that were motivated by the desire to invest more in projects. Now, if you think about it from an external perspective, don't look at the numbers. Which of these three has the potential to at least be good news? When you cut dividends to take projects, right? Guess what? When they cut dividends, on the day that they cut dividends, the market punished all three groups. Why? Because the market has no way of knowing whether you're making up stuff. But to give the market credit, if you track the stock price in the quarter after the dividend cut, guess what? You get some price back on the first two groups, but you get all of your money back by the end of the next quarter if you're transparent about why you do things. So when managers say we can't cut dividends, stock or the market will punish us, the answer is yes, it will. But if you have a good reason for cutting dividends, package it, be open about it, and then get down on your knees and hope and pray that the market does adjust back, because there's a history here of markets giving you credit if you did it for the right reasons. Any questions? Yes, Roy. Well, they wouldn't have lost their jobs. That's the key. Is if they'd done this in 86 or 87, would there have been pain? There would have been pain, but they could have done it in conjunction with some good news. What I'd have done is waited for a quarter where oil prices were up, when your earnings jump. Right? So combine it with news where people can see that this is a long-term problem you're fixing, not some short-term operational issue. Okay? And that's the advantage of doing it on your own terms, is you do it when it's right for you. The timing is right, and maybe you can buffer the impact. You still will get a stock price drop, but not by the magnitude you got when they were forced to do it. Okay. Next example I'm going to use is the Limited. It's tough to even remember the time when the Gap and the Limited were high-growth retail companies, because now they're dying. But this was the 80s and the early 90s, where the Gap and the Limited were opening new stores almost every week all over the country. So this was a period of high growth for the Limited, and they had free cash flow equity of minus $34.2 million. So again, not a trick question. If you have free cash flow equity of minus $34 million a year for 10 years, how much can you afford to pay in dividends? Answer is nothing, right? They managed to pay out $41 million in dividends on average over this 10-year period. And this was a period when they had great projects. They were earning well above their cost of equity. They're opening stores, and they're paying a dividend they can't afford to pay. And some of you might be working with companies like these. We have high growth, high returns, negative free cash flow equity, and the company's paying a dividend. You're saying, why are they paying a dividend? I don't know, but I could give you one possible pitch that might have gotten them started. So you're the Limited. You're not paying a dividend. I'm your consultant. I show up in your office and say, you know what? Because you don't pay a dividend, there are some investors who cannot buy your shares. Is that true? It is actually true. There are some pension funds that can invest only in companies that pay a dividend. So it's true. By not paying a dividend, those people can't buy your shares. So I suggest a compromise. I say, I know you guys can't afford a dividend, but why don't you pay a token dividend, a small dividend? You see the attraction of this? You pay a small dividend. You now can get on the list of all those pension funds that otherwise can't buy your shares. It's demand and supply, right? More people can buy your shares, so your price can go up. Admit it, you're tempted. What's the problem with that pitch, though? It's an extremely dangerous pitch. Tell me why. That's right. It's true, but use the words. What are the words I use for BP's investors to describe them? Dividend addicts, right? Try this on an addict. Go to him and say, would you like a little cocaine? Just a little bit, a token hit. It never works, right? You give him a token hit, next thing you know, boom, it's gone. Same thing applies here. You invite these people who like dividends, you give them a token dividend. What do they want next? They want more dividends. The Limited started off paying $1 million in dividends in their first year. 5 years later, they were paying $101 million in dividends. If you can't afford to pay dividends, don't invite these guys into the room, because they're not bad investors. They just like dividends. So when you're a company, you have to think about what investor base you're attracting, because that investor base has to be right for you. If you can't afford to pay dividends, you don't want to attract investors who like dividends. Final example, Tata Motors. Remember them? They're part of the Tata family group, right? Let me hit you with the high numbers, or the key numbers. During this period, which was a five-year period, Tata Motors could have paid about 48 billion rupees in dividends. That's a free cash flow to equity, the target debt ratio. They actually paid out 75 billion rupees in dividends. They paid far more in dividends than they were available in free cash flow to equity. But before you get too caught up in thinking about why, remember what happened when we looked at Tata Motors' capital structure? They borrowed more than they could. But how were they able to do that? Because the banks, when they lent money to Tata Motors, lent it based on the Tata family group, the other companies. The same problem applies here. If any of you are working with family group companies, do not be surprised to see strange-looking capital structures and strange-looking dividend policies. It might have nothing to do with this company, but it might have everything to do with what's good for the group. And that's part of the problem here, because as an investor in Tata Motors, you're saying this doesn't make sense, and it doesn't. But if you think about the Tata family, it may make complete sense from the perspective of all the companies they control. So I took all five of my companies, I put them on my matrix. Remember the matrix I talked about last session? On one axis, I look at whether you pay out more than your free cash flow equity or less than your free cash flow equity. Four of my companies actually paid out more than they could. Their dividends exceeded their free cash flow equity. And by dividends, I include dividends and buybacks. Only one actually held back cash, which was Baidu. And Baidu, you can see, can hold back cash because it has great projects. It's delivered great stock returns. It has the maximum flexibility to set its own dividend policy. The other four companies are all below the line. Three of them have good investments, Disney, Vale, and Tata Motors. So they're, in a sense, damaging themselves with this excessive payout. One, Deutsche Bank has both bad projects and pays out too much in dividends. That problem is a much deeper problem, because not only do you have to fix the dividend problem, but you have to go back and say, why are your returns so bad? Why aren't you earning a return on equity that exceeds your cost of equity? So when you're done with your dividends and free cash flow equity, think about this matrix, because it's going to give you at least some sense of why your companies might differ on dividend policy. So that's the second to last part of the project. Is you're going to bring your free cash flow equity and dividends into the process. You're going to look at the quality of their investments. And the question you're going to ask is, do I trust the management of this company with the cash? And please don't email me and ask me, can I trust the management? You know more about your company than I do at this point, or you should. Okay? So this is a judgment you have to make, and you have the numbers in front of you to make the judgment. That's why the numbers are there. Is for you to make judgment calls about, do you trust the managers of this company with your cash? Any questions about any part of dividends? Yes?
Yeah, a family group, would it be more wise to treat each company as independent and not carry the capital structure?
Well, that's part of the problem. You cannot, right? They're not independent because they're all being driven by the sense that they're all part of a group. So you'd like to treat them as independent. You're an investor in an independent company, but they're not behaving like independent companies.
Okay.
There might be a benefit, but what you lose, the family group might lose out. So in a sense, there's a benefit to you as an investor, but it might not be a benefit to the Tata family. And if it becomes a choice between what's good for you and what's good for them, they're going to win out every single time. Now, when we talked about capital structure, we talked about how most companies decide how much to borrow, right? They looked at everybody else in the sector and they tried to stay as close as they could to industry averages. I said, maybe that's what's driving dividend policy as well. So I took each of my five companies and I looked at the dividend yield and the dividend payout ratio, again for the most recent year and the average over the previous 5 years, and compared it to what the average was for the sector. So let me take an example. Disney's dividend yield was 1.09%. Its payout ratio was about 22%. The industry average was 0.96% for the dividend yield, so very close to 1.09, and 22.5% for the payout ratio. If I didn't know better, I would say the way Disney is setting its dividend policy, it takes the entertainment sector, takes the average, and tries to stay as close as it can to the average. Vale's dividend yield is 6.56%. The payout ratio is 113. You're saying, that's dysfunctional? But look at the sector. It's a dysfunctional company in a dysfunctional sector. And Vale's defenses were not as bad as those guys. Look at, they're worse. Their payout ratio is 316%. You look at Tata Motors, 1.31% dividend yield, 16% payout ratio. That is lower than the sector, than the automobile sector. We're looking at global automobile companies. Baidu, no dividends across the board. But before you get too caught up in that, most companies in the sector either pay really tiny dividends or don't pay dividends. And lastly, when I looked at Deutsche, dysfunctional company, but again, in a sector where everybody pays hefty dividends. A lot of what you see in dividend policy, as I said, is me-tooism and inertia. Companies trying to look like everybody else. So that's the key to thinking about companies, is to think about the sector. And if you want to break down individual companies, you're going to see very quickly how much difference there exists within a sector on individual companies. For instance, Disney looks a lot like the sector, right? When I look at the average dividend yield. So I took all the entertainment companies. And if you look across all the entertainment companies, look at the number of companies in the sector that pay no dividends. Lots of small, risky companies that pay no dividends. The median dividend yield for an entertainment company is actually zero. But I would not recommend that Disney pay no dividends because the median entertainment company is so different in terms of risk and growth than Disney is. So when you look at comparing to the sector, again, you can look at the sector averages, but don't get too carried away because within that sector, there can be big differences across companies. So the final piece in the capital structure section when I did this was I ran a regression for the entire market. Remember that I took the debt ratio for every company in the U.S. market, ran regressions against all those variables that drive debt. That's how I ended this section. I took the dividend payout ratio and dividend yield for U.S. companies and regressed them against the risk of the companies, my hypothesis being risky companies should pay a lower dividends than safe companies, against the earnings growth rate, high growth companies should pay lower dividends than low growth companies, and finally against how much debt ratio had. The rationale being companies that have a lot more debt can afford to pay out more in dividends because the cash that comes in from debt can be used to service dividends. All my coefficients are in the right direction. All those T statistics are significant, but just to add a qualifier, the R squareds are not great. The R-squared is 20% for the payout ratio regression and about 25% for the dividend yield regression. That's not my fault. That's a way. Lots of differences in dividends across companies that cannot be explained by fundamentals. And here's what I can do. Once I have this regression, I can plug in the numbers for any company into this regression. Now, I'm going to do this just for Disney so we can see whether Disney's existing payout ratio and yield fit into what the rest of the market is doing. And when I plug in the numbers for Disney, here's what I get. Based on how everybody else in the sector is paying out dividends, Disney's dividend yield should be 1.4%. Its payout ratio should be 27%. So all I did was took the regression from the previous page, plugged in Disney's numbers. Their actual dividend yield is slightly lower, 1.09%. Their actual payout ratio is slightly lower. Okay? So if you're going to go this road of looking at other companies, might as well expand the sample, use some basic statistics, control for differences, and do the best you can. I'd much rather that you looked at your company to make this judgment, but if you're going to make your judgment looking at other companies, at least make it an expansive analysis. Any questions on dividend policy? Okay. So we're in the final piece of the puzzle. As many of you know, there are two classes I teach. I teach this class and I teach the valuation class. And I've generally not done this at for the undergraduate, but I've done it at the MBA level. They get me in the spring of the first year and the spring and the fall of the next year. This is the first spring I haven't taught valuation in 20-something years. because I'm teaching two corporate finance sections. And I'm often asked, because when people go through the classes, what's the difference between your two classes? And here's the way I describe my two classes. Corporate finance, I look at companies from the inside out. You know what I mean by the inside out? I'm looking at managing companies, what projects to take, how much to borrow. Valuation, I look at the same companies from the outside in. The principles stay the same, but I have a lot less power over how a company's run. So I'm going to start off my valuation section with a quote from Oscar Wilde. He said, he described a cynic as somebody who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. You could replace the word cynic with trader, and you pretty much get the same thing. And it's not meant as an insult. Traders can price everything. That's their job. It's not their job to value things. And 95% of what happens on Wall Street is trading. You heard Carl Icahn described as an activist investor, right? He's really an activist trader. Why? Because he's really not got that much interest in investing. He wants to buy a low price. He's very successful at it. I'm not saying he's... But he is a trader, not an investor. He's focused on pricing. So one of the things we're going to talk about as we go through this last stretch is the difference between pricing something and valuing it. And I'll give you the analogy that I think best fits. I know most of you are too young to own your own apartment. Anybody here own a house or an apartment? If anybody puts up their hand, this is the person to hit up anytime you're short for dinner. You know, this person picks up the bill. Okay, nobody here put up their hands. Okay? At some point in time, you plan to buy a house or an apartment, right? Or a mansion or a castle or something like that. No. So let's say you find the castle you want. A realtor shows you the castle. Well, let's make it a mansion. Castles are kind of tough to find. A mansion, all the mansions. So after she shows you the mansion or he shows you the mansion, the realtor names a price. How did the realtor come up with that price, that number? Other mansions that sold around, and then she said, you have an extra bedroom, a bigger backyard, therefore it's $3.5 million, right? Have you ever seen a realtor do a discounted cash flow valuation of the house saying, you know what, now the discount rate I'm using is 8%. No, it doesn't work that way. It's pure pricing. Pricing has nothing to do with cash flows, growth, and risk. It's got everything to do with what are other people paying for things just like this. You're an eBay. You're pricing. That's pricing. Valuation is about looking at the cash flows, the growth, and the risk. So let me set the table for why we care. Why are we talking about valuation in the context of a corporate finance class? Because the objective in corporate finance is to maximize value. I've danced around the word value for 24 sessions. I can't dance anymore. It's finally time to talk about how do all these decisions you make on capital budgeting and capital structure and dividend policy show up in value. So it's time to meet that number. So I'm going to set the table here. There are three ways you can put a number on an asset or a company. There are only three ways. Everything you see in the world has to fall into one of these three buckets. The first is what I'm going to call intrinsic valuation. What's intrinsic valuation? You value a company, you value an asset based on its specific characteristics, its cash flows, its growth, its risk. You do a discounted cash flow valuation, you're doing an intrinsic valuation. The second is what we just talked about, relative valuation. When I ask you how much will you pay for this, rather than trying to figure out what the value of it is, you look at what other people are paying for things just like it, and you say, you know what, other people are paying $1,000 for something like this, that's what I'm going to put. That's pricing or relative valuation. So you can have intrinsic valuation, you can have pricing. And there's a third approach, and this is perhaps the only aspect of valuation that's new and different. There are some businesses, some assets, and we talked about this towards the very end of capital budgeting, that have optionality. Sounds fancy, but let me give you an example. You're valuing a young biotechnology company. How young? It has no revenues, no earnings, no cash flows. But it's got a really promising product working its way through the pipeline, the FDA pipeline. You can't value this company with cash flows. There are none. It's all negative cash flows. They're all R&D expenses. You can't value, you can't price it. Because what are you going to price it against? You know, there's no earnings, no book value, no nothing. It's an option. Why is it an option? Because if the FDA approves the drug, it could be a blockbuster drug. If it doesn't, you have nothing. You're buying an option. So that's what's called contingent claim valuation. But basically, we're not going to talk about this in the context of this class, but that's really the only aspect of valuation which is new and different. In fact, in this class, we're going to talk only about intrinsic valuation because it's what ties us back to corporate finance. So when you think about the value of an asset, think about the valuation theory. There's not much theory. In fact, when I put up a valuation of a company, usually the insults come flying in. I get accused of being an academic, and the way they say the word academic, it's not meant as a compliment. It's like academic. It's like an insult. And I let that roll. But once in a while, I get accused of being a valuation theorist. And I laugh, because I know exactly how little theory there is in my entire class. It's 26 sessions in my MBA class. It'll be 28 if it were an undergraduate class. You know how much theory there is? It's one equation. Now tell me whether you see this equation is familiar. The value of an asset is the present value of the expected. That's it. That's my entire theory. The entire class is about estimating cash flows and coming up with a better discount rate. There is no theory. And when I think about valuation, while that equation is at the center of the game, I think about four questions to which I need answers to value a company. And I'll tell you what the four questions are. And as I list these questions, think about your company, think about any company you want, because these are the drivers of value. The first question I'm going to ask you is, what are your cash flows from your existing assets? Remember that financial balance sheet? Existing assets and growth assets. So what are your cash flows from existing assets? You know what you're going to hand me in return? Your annual report, your 10K, because that's what I'm going to see, right? Earnings and cash flows. That's the easiest part of valuation, is nailing that down. But now comes the tough part. The second question I'm going to ask you is, what is the value you're going to create with future growth? Notice how I phrase the question. I'm going to ask you, what's your future growth? Because growth by itself can be good, bad, or neutral. What's a good side of growth? Small numbers become big numbers, right? You're small. So that's a good side. What's a bad side of growth? How did that growth happen? It didn't happen magically. You had to open factories, you had to build. So the bad side of growth is, while your earnings are growing fast, you also have to put more money back into the business for your earnings to grow. So which effect is going to dominate? What do you think we did the net present value of a project and the return on capital? This is it, right? That's exactly what it's going to drive. If you're a company that can grow and earn a 15% return on capital and your cost of capital is 10%, you are going to add value as you grow. If you're a company that grows and earns a return on capital of 10% and a cost of capital of 10%, you can grow as much as you want, but you're basically running in place. And if you're a company that grows and earns a 6% return on capital and your cost of capital is 10%, you can grow, but you'll actually destroy value as you grow. There's a connection to that return section. That's why I asked you, do you think this company can keep doing what it does? Because that's going to tell me when I get to the valuation stage, or more importantly, it'll tell you, is this the kind of company that's going to create value, do nothing for value, or destroy value? So what are your cash flows from existing assets? What's the value created, destroyed, or destroyed by growth? Third question I'm going to ask you is, how risky are these cash flows? Hey, we spend the entire class dancing with this question, right? And when we talk about risk, we might talk about betas and default spreads and ratings and all the rest. But ultimately, I'm asking, how risky are these cash flows? And even if you don't buy into betas and the CAPM and default spreads, here's the fundamental proposition that everybody should buy into. The riskier your cash flows, the lower the value you will attach to those assets. We can talk about how to measure risk, but how risky are your cash flows? And then I'm going to ask you a final question. It's going to sound like a strange question. I'm going to ask you, when will your company become a mature company? You think, what the hell are you talking about? What do mature companies do? They don't drink and drive. But here's my definition of mature company, and here's why. Mature company is a company that grows at a rate less than or equal to the economy. You say, why do you care? What did I say this equation was? Value of an asset is the present value of the expected cash flows in the asset over its lifetime, right? You're valuing a publicly traded company. What's the lifetime of a publicly traded company? You look at a corporate charter. It tells you when the company was founded, right? When does it tell you the company is going to be liquidated or wound up? It doesn't mention it. So at least in theory, your company can keep going and going and going and going and going forever, right? So to value this company, what do you have to do? Estimate cash flows forever. This is my vision of hell. First I show up in hell, I'm pretty pissed off. I don't want to be there. But I'm there. Then I see the devil walking towards me. He's dressed up like an investment banker. Don't ask me why. He says, welcome to hell. We have deals to make. I don't want to deal with this guy, but I have no choice, I guess. So I say, okay. What am I going to be doing? He's saying, you're going to be doing a lot of valuation. I say, okay, that's not too bad. That's what I used to do in my regular life. Where am I going to be working? He points me to a stool and a table and a laptop. And my vision of hell already takes form. It's a Dell. You seen one of those Dells where they made the back blue or green and said, look how stylish this Dell is. So this is my vision of hell. I'm stuck below the surface working on a Dell. Okay, I can live with that. Who am I valuing? GE. That's my other vision of hell taking form. If you gave me a company that's a nightmare company to value, it'd be GE. So, okay, now it's getting really bad. I'm working on a Dell. I'm valuing GE. What do you want me to do? Project cash flows. Okay, I can do that. For how long? Forever. It's a spreadsheet that never ends. Can you keep going? Column 10, column 15, column 16,255. You're still working. This is why you don't want to go to hell. And this is why the world we're in, the question you often get asked is, can I stop now? How about right now? Do I have to do an extra year? And I have an answer to the question. You can stop if you're willing to make an assumption. You know what that assumption has to be? That beyond that point in time, your cash flows will grow at a constant rate forever. What does it buy you? A growing perpetuity. How does it save you trouble then? If you have a growing perpetuity, what can you do? You can stop estimating cash flows and compute the value for all the years beyond. That's so glorious. But it comes with a catch. Your cash flows have to grow at a constant rate forever, right? So now complete the rest of the story. How high can that rate be? Can it be 5% a year forever? What's a cap on that rate? If it's going to be a growth rate forever for an individual company, what's a maximum that number can be? It cannot exceed the risk-free. The risk-free is a good one. That's my proxy. But the risk-free is actually a proxy for something else, a nominal growth rate of the economy. Why? Let's complete it. We know it's obviously why. But what will happen to a company growing at a rate faster than the economy? Forever. It'll become the economy. Then what? Globalization? Okay, 25 years and it's going to be the global economy. Then what? Interplanetary travel? There are some assumptions in finance where you and I can agree to disagree. So if you say Netflix will grow 80% a year for the next 10 years and I say it's 40%, that's a difference in assumptions. If I say Netflix is going to have a 2% growth in perpetuity and you say it's 6% a year in perpetuity, your problem is not with me, it's with mathematics. And guess what? You fight math, math always wins. Now, remember the question I asked you? When will your company be a mature company? Why do I need that? Because the minute you answer that, that's when I stop estimating my cash flows. I estimate that big elephant in the room that we call the terminal value, which is the value of the company beyond that point in time. It allows us to put closure. When I think about valuations, I think about the answers to those questions. So let's frame how we can think about valuation. I have a business, and I ask you to come in and value my company. When you come in, you have to decide what you're valuing. Let me explain. Let's suppose my business is equity investors, so you guys are all equity investors, and you guys are my bondholders and lenders. So I raised equity from you, I took a bank loan from you, I started the business. The first way to think about valuation is to focus just on the equity investors and to value the equity. So let me be specific. When I'm trying to value equity investors, I look at the cash flows you make as equity investors, which is cash flows left over after the interest payments and principal payments. In fact, wouldn't we just do this last session? The free cash flow at equity is basically... So if you're equity investors, the cash flow I'm going to look at is cash flows after debt payments, cash flows to equity. And I'm going to discount those cash flows at the rate of return you guys wanted to make when you invested in my shares. Does that sound familiar? That's the cost of equity. So if I take cash flows to equity and discount at the cost of equity, what I get as a present value is the value of the equity in my business. In fact, if I wanted to be really rigid, I could say, look, this free cash flow to equity is all mirage. The only cash flow you get in the mail from the company as an equity investor is what? Dividends. The dividend discount model is a special case of an equity valuation model. So the first way to do valuation is to focus on equity, cash flows to equity, discount at the cost of equity, you get a value for equity. Here's the second way. Rather than focus on just the equity investors, what if I looked at the collective claim holders in the firm? Remember, I got money from the lenders and money from you. You get free cash flows to equity. Did you guys collect any cash flows from the company? Or what cash flows do you as lenders get from the company? Come on, you lend me money. You expect something back, right? Abby, what do you get back? Interest payments and principal payments. So you get cash flows, you call it interest payments. You get cash flows, you call it free cash flow to equity. The collective cash flow that you both get from the business is called the cash flow to the firm. And if that is the cash flow that I'm discounting, the discount rate I should use should be a weighted average of what these guys want, which is the cost of equity, and what you want, which is the cost of debt, which, of course, we've labeled the cost of capital. Cash flow to the entire business discounted back at the cost of capital gives me the value of the entire business. And if I want to get to the value of equity, I can still get there, right? All I have to do is subtract out what I owe those guys, the lenders, and I'll end up with the value for equity. So there are two ways you can value equity, either directly by taking cash flow to equity and discounting at the cost of equity, or valuing the whole business and subtracting our debt to get to a value for equity. Yes?
The second way always be higher.
No, because what will happen, the business value will be higher, but you still have to subtract out the debt, right? So by the time you subtract out the debt, you should end up, in fact, if you do this right, and you might not believe me on this, your value of equity should be exactly the same using both approaches. In fact, we did a variant of this when we did capital budgeting. Remember I said with Vale, I did a net present value using equity cash flows and the cost of equity. It's exactly the same notion expanded to valuation overall. So one of the first things you have to do when you walk into a valuation scenario is you have to make up your mind. Am I valuing the business or am I valuing equity? Because the way you frame your choices will then be determined by what you're valuing. So often the first thing you have to do when you sit down to do valuation is you have to decide, what am I going to be discounting? I know it's a discounted cash flow valuation, but what's the cash flow I'm going to be discounting? Because you could discount dividends, you can discount free cash flow to equity, or you can discount cash flow to the firm. Then I'll give you a very simple rubric that helps me. Use dividends only if you're desperate. Desperate in what sense? If you cannot estimate cash flows, all you can do is use dividends, right? You say, when would I not be able to estimate cash flows? But the one sector where I said, I'm going to have a really tough time estimating cash flows, where CapEx is tough to identify, working capital is really messy, financial service companies. Pre-2008, if you look at every one of my valuation books, you get to the chapter on valuing banks. Here's what I say. Valuing banks is deceptively simple. It's deceptively simple because you have no idea what's going on behind the curtain. So what I'm going to do, and this is the pre-2008 me, I would say, for these companies, I'm going to take dividends paid by these companies, and because I can't estimate cash flows, I'm going to discount those dividends and say the value of JP Morgan is X, because that's the present value of dividends. But implicit in doing that were two assumptions. The first was the assumption that banks were run by sensible people. And the second was the assumption that they paid out what they could afford to in dividends. And pre-2008, I was willing to enter into that bargain. But post-2008, there is zero chance I'm doing that because I no longer believe that banks are run by sensible people, and I no longer believe that they pay out what they can afford to pay out in dividends. So I'll talk about how that transition will play out when I value a bank, but dividends get used only if you get truly desperate. So the real choice is free cash flow to equity or free cash flow to the firm. And here's the way I make that choice. You remember that shortcut I showed you for the free cash flow to equity? Net income minus net capex times 1 minus the debt ratio minus change in working capital. And I said you can use that if the debt ratio is stable. If you have a company where you feel that the debt ratio they're using now is the debt ratio they plan to use forever, let's say it's 30%, they've used 30% for the last 20 years, then you can use free cash flow equity and get away with it. But most of the time when you look at a company, here's what you're going to see. You're going to see a debt ratio, and you'll have no idea whether the debt ratio is stable or not, whether it's going to go up or not. Those scenarios do the free cash flow of the firm. Free cash flow of the firm is always a safer choice because you can change your mind about the debt ratio later. It's much more difficult to do that with free cash flow equity. So dividends versus free cash flow equity, you go the dividends route only if you're desperate. Free cash flow equity or free cash flow of the firm is based on what you think about. Will this company's debt ratio be stable? So here are the inputs that drive valuation. You can see very quickly why your choice has to be made up front. So you guys are going to value equity. You guys are going to value the firm. I'm going to come to you with inputs, and you tell me how your numbers are going to be different. Ready? So you're valuing the equity. You're valuing the entire business. So I ask you, what are your cash flows? As equity investors, what are you going to give me? Cash flows after taxes, after reinvestment, after debt payments, free cash flow equity. Or you might say, look, I know, dividends, something, but a cash flow equity. But when I ask you that question, because I'm looking at the entire business, the cash flow you should give me should be after taxes and after reinvestment, but before debt payments. Why? Because debt holders are now part of the business. So already you can see two very different numbers. Then I ask you, what's your growth going to be? As equity investors, you care about growth in equity earnings, net income, earnings per share. But when I ask you that question, the growth rate you should be talking about should be growth in operating income and revenues. It's for the entire business. Then I ask you, what discount rate should you apply? And as equity investors, the answer you're going to give me is the cost of equity. But when I ask you that question, the discount rate should be the cost of capital. The closure question should be the same for both your groups. But you, when you get to that closure point, are going to tell me how much the equity in this company will be worth 10 years out, whereas you'll tell me what the company itself will be worth 10 years out. It's amazing how often I see people who claim to know valuation get mixed up in the middle of a valuation as to what exactly they're valuing. I've talked to equity research analysts. They'll be in the middle of valuing a business, the entire firm. And I'll ask you, where do you get your growth rate? And they say, oh, that's the earnings per share growth in the last 10 years. See what the fundamental inconsistency there? You're valuing the business. The growth you should be thinking about is growth in operating income, and all of a sudden, magically, you're putting in earnings per share growth. Make up your mind early in the process and stay consistent. Are you playing the equity game? Are you playing the business game? So I'm going to take each piece, and as I go along, I'm going to talk about specifics. And as I go through these specifics, you're going to see a lot of familiar pages because, in a sense, we've already laid the groundwork for valuing Disney, Vale, and you've laid the groundwork in your company for doing the valuation of your company. So first question you're going to run into is cash flows. And as I said, cash flows can either be cash flows to equity or cash flows to the firm. If it's cash flow to the firm, here's how I'm going to compute it. I'm going to start with operating income. Why? Because it's a pre-debt cash flow. So I've got to climb up the income statement. I'm going to act like I pay taxes on that operating income, even though I don't. I'm going to subtract out my reinvestment needs, captured as CapEx and working capital, and I'm going to come up with free cash flow to the firm. If that looks familiar, and it should, that's how we computed cash flows for Netflix and the Disney theme park, where we're doing cash flows to the firm. If you're talking about cash flow to equity, you could get really lazy and just do dividends. You could get slightly lazy and add buybacks to dividends because increasingly U.S. companies are doing it. Or you could do it right and estimate potential dividends, which is free cash flow to equity. Already you see four different definitions of cash flows, but you don't get to pick and choose. You have to make your choice up front. So let's try this for Disney, for Deutsche Bank first. Deutsche pre-2008, I followed the route of, hey, it's a bank, I can't estimate cash flows, so I'm going to use dividends. So I'm going to show you a valuation of Deutsche from early 2008 based on a dividend discount model. And implicit there is the belief that banks are run by sensible people. They're paying out what they can afford to. Then I'm going to show you a valuation in November of 2013 after my days of innocence were in the past, where I said, I don't trust banks. I'm not going to take the dividends as a given. I'm going to estimate the free cash flow equity. But that did open a problem for me because CapEx was still difficult. Working capital was still difficult. If you remember, the way I estimated free cash flow equity for a bank was I treated reinvestment in regulatory capital as if it were CapEx. And you can already see the distinction, the difference I'm getting in what the bank tells me they can afford to pay, which is the dividend, and what they can actually afford to pay. In 2014, Deutsche actually paid a dividend. But if we look at the free cash flow to equity, it's a big negative number. So when I value equity, I'm going to trust the free cash flow to equity saying that's the truth, the dividend is the lie. But you can see the shift in perspective on banks showing up in my valuation. So dividend to free cash flow to equity. For Tata Motors, here's what I did. I went back 5 years. I started with the net income. And I tried to compute how much of that net income was available as free cash flow to equity each year by looking at CapEx, depreciation, change in working capital, and how much debt they brought in or repaid. The key number to focus on is the second to last column. That's how much Tata Motors put back into the company each year. So in the first year, they had a minus 25 billion rupee net income, but they reinvested 62 billion rupees, which is not a problem. They're a cyclical company, I understand that. But across the 5 years, they reinvested almost 88% of their net income back into the business. Is it good or bad? It depends. Depends on what? How good their investments are. I haven't given you the other half of the equation. So when you see that other half, you can pass complete judgment. But they were reinvesting a lot. But here I'm focusing on cash flows to equity, how much of the equity investors reinvested. For Disney, I'm actually going to value the entire business. So there, rather than start with net income, I'm going to start with operating income. The operating income for Disney was $10,032 million. Adjusted for leases. What the heck does that mean, adjusted for leases? What exactly did I do to leases that's causing this adjustment? I capitalized the lease, right? Which creates a problem for me. It creates debt, but it also means that I can no longer trust the operating income to be right because that operating income is computed after subtracting out lease expense. So adjusted for leases means I'm adding back the lease expense saying I should not have subtracted it out. But then I have to subtract out the depreciation I will get on that leased asset to complete the story. So my operating income reflects my perspective that leases are really debt. Incidentally, starting in 2019, both GAAP and IFRS will require that for all companies. So what I'm doing manually now will get done by all companies as part of their financials. And then I looked at the effective tax rate. And therein lies a puzzle because when we talked about cost of debt, and I talked about the after-tax cost of debt. Do you remember what tax rate I kind of was emphatic you should use to come up with the cost of debt? And the marginal tax rate. And what was my rationale for why the marginal tax rate? It's not fair because I was the one who gave you the rationale, but let's see if you remember my rationale. Why are you supposed to use the marginal tax rate when you do the after-tax cost of debt? It's like 38, 40%. Because interest saves you taxes at the margin. It's the last dollar of income that you protect from taxes because of interest expenses, right? So if you have $100 in income and $10 in interest expenses, your taxable income goes from 100 to 90. It's between the 90 and the 100 you save on taxes. So when we do cost of debt, it's absolute. You always use the marginal tax rate. But when you do cash flows, the entire business, the rules get a little fuzzier. And here's why. Now I'm no longer talking about the last dollar. I'm talking about all of Disney's income, which is $10,032 million. In 2013, they paid an effective tax rate of 31% across all their income. Now do you see why here I can stay with the effective tax rate? Because as long as they defer taxes, collectively they're not going to pay 40% of their income. They're going to pay a lower number. I'll have to still come back and ask the question, will that tax rate change over time? Because clearly you can't defer taxes forever, but I'm going to start the process off with a 31% effective tax rate. Their CapEx, which includes acquisitions, was $5.23 billion. Their depreciation was about $2.2 billion, and the working capital increased by $103 million. So let's work through the numbers. $10,032 million net of taxes is $6.92 billion. I subtract out the net CapEx, which is the difference between CapEx and depreciation, and the change in working capital. My free cash flow to the firm is $3.2 billion. What does that even mean? When I say the free cash flow to Disney is $3.2 billion, what are all the uses to which that free cash flow is going to be put? First thing that I have to do with that free cash flow is do what? Remember, it's pre-debt, right? So I've got to make interest payments and principal payments. That's the first claim. What else is going to come out of that free cash flow? Sorry? Dividends are going to come out. Stock buybacks are going to come out. And if after all of that there's something left over, where is it going to go? It's going to go into the cash balance. Right? This is all after CapEx. It can't be going into projects. It can't be going into theme parks. I've already subtracted out CapEx and working capital. So free cash flow to the firm is what I use to service all my different claim holders. And that free cash flow is $3.188 billion. And at least in 2013, if I look at how much Disney reinvested, which is $3.7 billion, as a percentage of their after-tax operating income, Disney reinvested 54% of their after-tax operating income back into the business. And again, I don't know whether that's good or bad until I look at how good those investments are. So that goes in the Shanghai theme park, it goes into acquisitions, it goes into Marvel, it goes into new movies, whatever it is, that's where it is, the 54%. So that's the cash flow part, and you can see very quickly that we've taken what we did in capital budgeting and kind of expanded it to the whole company. Any questions on cash flows? Okay. Let's talk about discount rates. One of the points I kind of kept emphasizing through capital budgeting was to be consistent. Remember that? I said, if your cash flows are in dollars, make sure your discount rate is in dollars. If your cash flows are in rupees, make sure your discount rate is in rupees. Now I've added another consistency issue. If your cash flows are after debt payments, make sure your discount rate is a cost of equity. But if they're before debt payments, your discount rate has to be a cost of capital. That consistency issue is critical when you do DCF valuation. You cannot mix and match cash flows and discount rates. So once you tell me how you estimate the cash flows, my discount rate has to be tailored to how you estimated the cash flows. So all I need to do my valuation are costs of equity and costs of capital, right? And this is a nice thing about doing valuation at the end of a corporate finance class. Did we do cost of equity and cost of capital for each of our companies already? In fact, for your project company, hopefully you're past that stage, right? You have a cost of equity and a cost of capital. You've got the cost of equity and capital you need to value the company. That's exactly the number I'm going to use. In fact, for Deutsche, here's what I'm going to use to discount those dividends in 2008 and the free cash flow equity in 2013. In 2008, here's how I computed the cost of equity for Deutsche. I started with a risk-free rate in euros. Why? Because all my dividends were in euros. My cash flows are in euros, so my discount rate has to be in euros. The risk-free rate in euros in 2008 was 4%. That was the German 10-year bond rate in 2008. The beta that I came up with was a bottom-up levered beta, exactly the same rules that we followed so far, 1.16. And the equity risk premium in early 2008 was 4.5%. The cost of equity you're going to see in my dividend discount model valuation of Deutsche is 9.2% in 2008. Let me move forward 5 years. November 2013, I'm still doing everything in euros, but my risk-free rate has gone from 4% down to 1.75%. Holding all else constant, that should bring down my cost of equity a lot, right? But look at what else changed. This is post-crisis. My risk premium, which is 4.5%, has now jumped to 6.12%. My beta hasn't changed much. In fact, my cost of equity has changed remarkably little between 2008 and 2013, even though the risk-free rate has dropped. If I were valuing Deutsche today, what's the risk-free rate in euros look like right now? Somebody must be doing a euro valuation. It's not quite negative. Swiss franc, I know, has gone negative. No. Sorry? It's like 0.5%. But again, you got to bring in the fact that risk premiums have expanded even further. That 6.12% is now 6.8%. The levered beta for Deutsche is close to 1.25. You can see that the cost of equity is not just the risk-free rate, that everything in this process changes. So I'm going to estimate the cost of equity for Deutsche at the time of each valuation and use that as my discount rate. For Tata Motors, since I'm going to be doing a free cash flow equity valuation, I need a cost of equity for Tata Motors. Let me go through steps. I'm going to do my valuation in Indian rupees. So what's the first thing I need? Let's make this a review session. You need a risk-free rate in Indian rupees, right? Somebody remind me how I get a risk-free rate in Indian rupees. What do I start with? I start with a 10-year Indian government bond rate, which is 8.82% at that time. And then I subtract from that the default spread for India, which was 2.25%. I come up with a risk-free rate of 6.57%. Got one input done. I need a beta for Tata Motors. How do I get that? I could run a regression and cheat. But remember all those regressions I showed you for Tata Motors? The beta's all over the place. So instead, what do you think I did? I took a bottom-up beta for global automobile companies. I adjusted for Tata Motors' debt-to-equity ratio. You think we did this already? You're right. We did this already. We're just putting it to a different use. The beta that I ended up with for Tata Motors as a bottom-up beta was 0.964. Then let me ask you the final question. Let's see if you fully remember what we did pre-quiz one. I need an equity risk premium for Tata Motors. And what do I need to do to get that equity risk premium? That's true, but before I get there, Griffin, what do I need to do? You have to figure out geographically what Tata Motors is an Indian company, but remember its biggest market, very close, was China, right? So in a sense, I need that weighted average. So the cost of equity is exactly the same cost of equity each of you is computing for your companies. That then becomes the cost of equity. So the 13.5% Indian rupee cost of equity for Tata Motors reflects all the lessons from corporate finance. You don't change those rules just because you're doing valuation. And I need a cost of capital for Disney. So I'm going to ask for your help again. I'm going to do it in U.S. dollars, so I need a risk-free rate in U.S. dollars. The T-bond rate in November of 2013 was 2.75%, so that's my risk-free rate. So what do I need to get a beta for Disney? Or how did I get this 1.0013? That seems magically precise, fourth decimal point. What did I do? I broke Disney down into five businesses, right? Theme parks, broadcasting. I got the betas for each business. I took a weighted average. Hey, it's coming back into use again. That 1.0013 is the bottom-up beta for Disney, levered to reflect its debt-to-equity ratio. And the equity risk premium of 5.76% reflects the fact that Disney gets 82% of its revenues in the U.S. and 18% outside. My cost of equity is the sum total of all of those, 8.52%. For the cost of debt, do you remember what I did for Disney? What are the two ways you can get a cost of debt? You should be doing this in your project right now. You can check to see if you have a rating and find if you have bonds and rating. And or you can, if you can't find that, you do a synthetic rating. I did both for Disney. I got a single A rating from S&P for Disney. That was an actual rating. I got a synthetic rating of AA, and then I said, you know what, much as I'm tempted by hubris to go with my synthetic rating, I'm going to go with the actual rating because those guys did their homework a little deeper than I did. That actual rating of single A transferred into a default spread of 1%, added to the 2.75%. That's my pre-tax cost of debt. And here I use the marginal tax rate of 36.1% for Disney to come up with an after-tax cost of debt of 2.4%. So I got my cost of equity, I got my cost of debt. What's the last step? I need weights. And what do those weights reflect? Market values. Market value of equity, market value of debt. Market value of equity, of course, is easy. It's a publicly traded company. Market value of debt, I have to take the interest-bearing debt and play those little games. But what else did I have to bring in? The lease debt. So basically, this is the total debt for Disney, including the leases. Now you see why I had to use the lease-adjusted operating income, because once I decided to go down this road, I had to keep going. My cost of capital for Disney, at least in 2013, was 7.81%. So I'm going to use this in valuing Disney, right? But here I'm going to add a layer of complication or reality that you don't deal with in capital budgeting, but you have to deal with in valuation. Tell me again what you're doing in a spreadsheet when you value a company. You take your existing company, you put in growth rate assumptions, you come up with numbers for the next 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. So let's say you have a high growth company. What's going to happen to that growth over time? If you're being realistic, the growth should start to slow down. Your company will go from being a high growth company, potentially making very little money, to a lower growth company, presumably making more money. And that's all happening on your spreadsheet, right? Early on, though, when you're a high-growth company, which is losing money or making very little money, you have a high cost of capital. Why? Because you're a risky company. You can't afford to borrow money, right? So I understand. But on your spreadsheet, as you go from year 1 to year 2 to year 3 to year 4 to year 5 to year 6, do you see what should be happening to your cost of capital as well to be internally consistent? If you're telling me your company is going to become a lower-growth, more mature company over time, your cost of capital should also start to reflect that. In the case of Disney, that adjustment was relatively small. It's already a large, mature company, so I didn't have to do too many changes. But here's what I changed. The beta I hardly changed, 1.0, you're already at an average beta. But if Disney's beta had been 1.8, you see how much more work I'd have had to do, because I'd have had to bring the beta down towards 1, maybe not to 1, but towards 1 as the company became a mature company. Disney's rating is already single A. There's nothing I needed to do. But if its rating had been triple C and I was making it a mature, profitable company, that triple C could have become a triple B. So in the case of Disney, neither the cost of equity nor the cost of debt changed much. But the debt ratio I used for Disney was their existing debt ratio. The reason I bring that up is when I did the optimal debt ratio for Disney, do you remember what I got as my optimal debt ratio? I got 40%. How come I didn't use that in my cost of capital when I valued the company? I mean, I see analysts do this all the time. Use a target debt ratio to value a company. They'll plug in a number, 30%, 25%, 40%. Most dangerous thing you can do on the face of the earth. You know why? Because you don't run the damn company. I might think the debt ratio is 40%, but Bob Iger runs the company. He doesn't like to borrow money. I do think he will borrow more money, but he might not push to the 40%. And that's the constant reminder you have to keep giving yourself, is you're not running the company. Don't play God. Don't act like you can change everything you want. That's what I mean when I say in valuation, you're looking at companies from the outside in. Because you don't get to change any of those levers. You're an investor in the company, so my cost of capital changes, but not by a huge amount. It starts at 7.81% and slides down to 7.29%. I know you guys are tired, but I want to end with a page. How many of you last summer worked, or during the course of your lives, have you ever worked on a valuation of a company in an investment bank, consulting firm? Anybody here has worked on a valuation? Gabby. So you're going to be my guinea pig. Don't worry. I'll make you look really good. Okay. When you have to value a company, one of the inputs you need is a growth rate for the future, right? How do you get that growth rate in your valuations? So whatever valuation you were involved in, where did the growth rate come from? And for the assumption, how, you know, where do you start to get that number?
If you would build out their financial statements
and look at their history. One is, so let's pause right there. The first thing you look at is history, right? And that's your first instinct as a human being when I ask you, what will your growth rate for your company be? I have no idea. Let me look at what happened over the last 5 years. First thing you look at is history. What else? You could ask, I'm sorry? You could look at other companies in the sector to see how much they're growing. So you could look at growth in the sector. What else? You're a startup, right? So when I ask you, when I do evaluation, one of the people I might ask is, what do you think the growth will be? And you give me a number. You might have made it up, but I have no idea. Now, totally, and that's actually what we do. We ask managers of companies, what's your growth rate going to be? As if you're going to get an unbiased answer. What's the management going to say? What horrible manager, we're going to ruin the company? No, they're going to say 30% growth. That's right, as far as the eye can see. So we look at history, we look at comparators, we ask managers, and if you're working as the low person on the totem pole in an investment bank or a consulting firm, guess what you do? You ask your managing director, what do you think I should use as a growth rate? And he likes to play God, or she likes to play God. Use 13.5%. He said, that guy's a genius. He seems to know the growth for every company off the top of his head. Hey, you plug in the 13.5%. The point I'm making is, in most valuations, growth becomes an exogenous input. It magically lands in your spreadsheet, and then it takes on a life of its own. And once you do that, you've lost control of your valuation. And here's why. Use the 13.5% growth rate, because the manager told you, managing director told you, history gave you. You plug in the number, you come up with the value for your company, and it's too low. You think, what do you mean too low? I'll give you a truth about valuation. If you ever go to work, in most valuations, you already have a number you want to come up with. And if you don't get there, you're really disappointed, or somebody's going to be really disappointed in you. So when you get too low a number and you made up the growth rate, what's your quick fix? Just go increase the growth rate. It's a made up number anyway. 13.5, 15.3, who's going to notice? 51.3, the combinations are magical, right? So you keep playing with the growth rate, you arrive at it destroys the entire point of valuation. And so here's the point I'm going to make. I don't have the power to endow your company with high growth. Growth has to be earned. In fact, if you're going to be a great growth company, you've got to pull off a really tough trick. And here's the trick you need to pull off. You need to reinvest a lot of money, a high percentage of your after-tax operating income or your income, right? You think, that's not difficult. I could do that. I could reinvest 80%. But while you're reinvesting a lot, you also have to earn a high return on that investment. Now do you see why that's so tough to pull off? A lot of companies can reinvest a lot, but they reinvest really badly. Or they reinvest very little and they reinvest very well. Great growth companies are able to pull off that really tough trick of reinvesting a lot and reinvesting well at the same time. What happens to them? They become the Googles, the Facebooks of the world. Most growth companies don't make it through that rubric. So when I think about growth, I will look at history. That'd be crazy for me not to look at history. I'll ask the managers. Most of the time I'll ignore what they say. I'll ask my managing director, but I know he knows nothing anyway. But then I'll look at the company itself because the clues for growth are there. And in fact, there's a very simple algebraic connection called sustainable growth that you can use to check your growth rate. It's not some equation that you should think of as mathematically always holding every year, but over time it will. And here's how you can think about it. If you're focused on equity income, the two numbers you want to focus on is what percentage of my net income am I reinvesting back in the business? It's called the retention ratio. In fact, it's the inverse of the payout ratio. If your payout ratio is 10%, 90% is your retention ratio. So I want that number to be a high number if you're going to grow fast. And then I want to ask you what kind of return on equity you make on that investment. If you have a 90% retention ratio and a 20% return on equity, 90% times 20% is an 18% growth. That becomes your growth in equity income. If I'm looking at operating income, I'm going to ask the same question, but I'm going to frame it differently. Instead of asking what percentage of your net income do you put back in the business, ask what percentage of your operating income do you put back in the business. With Disney, if you remember, that was 54%. Then I'm going to look at how well you reinvest, looking at what you earn as your return on invested capital. Those of you wondered why you did Section 5 of your project, it's because it lays the foundations for Section 10. You have no idea what Section 5 and Section 10 are? Don't worry. There is a Section 5 and a Section 10. If you're stuck on Section 2, you will get to 5 and 10 sometime this week. Or you have to. You have no choice. But in Section 5, I asked you, how good are your projects? Look at your return on capital. And he said, why am I looking at this boring accounting number? Because it's going to become the basis for asking, when does growth create value in my company? So let's stop there. I will actually send you a couple of links tomorrow for valuation. And you can start, if you want, working on the valuation of the company. Oh, you mean you're taking the government bond rate and subtracting the default spread?
Yeah, and I added my default spread. That's a mistake, right?
Yeah.
It was extraordinarily high, and I couldn't understand why.
Yeah, that's why.
People were like, how is that so high? Now I have to fix my model.
You double count it.
Yeah. So with every premium, you add your default spread, but with synthetic risk free rate.
Yeah, so you got that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
What did you do? So why is it even an issue? When have I used the regression beta?
And also, I'm talking about the operating income. This has operating leases. We subtract operating leases from the.
That's the standard accounting. Accounting does it. We reverse that.
Oh, we add back?
We treat leases as debt and add back the lease expense to the operating income. It's a conventional accounting, it is subtracted out and it shouldn't be. Okay, good.
So I was irresponsible and I never got my quiz.
The quiz coming up with me, I'll give it to you.
Okay. Yeah. I had a couple other questions too.
I think he's waiting for his quiz too. So.
I just have class right now.
You know what, I've pinned it on my door. When I leave, okay. I'll pin it on my door, I promise.
Yeah.
Let's take the difference.